You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out why President Trump is calling for an end to the legislative filibuster.
First, since Hurricane Harvey hit Texas last weekend, natural disasters have been at the top of the news. Our next guest says we should be preparing for another kind of disaster, earthquakes, even here in the Midwest.
She says that despite what you might think, earthquakes can happen just about anywhere, and human activity from building high-rises to drilling for oil is having an added and significant impact on seismic activity, making the next big earthquake not a matter of if, but a matter of when.
With that in mind, are we as a country ready for the big earthquake to hit, and what do we need to know about earthquakes in order to better understand them and prepare for them?
Catherine Miles joins us now. She's a journalist and writer-in-residence for Green Mountain College. Her new book is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, it's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, Catherine, you start your book talking about a poster someone gave you, a friend, about where earthquakes have been picked up in the United States. And I thought, you know, this poster is going to show a lot of activity on the West Coast, near the San Andreas Fault, maybe up in Washington and Portland area. But you say the whole map is pretty much filled with light for these different trajectories of earthquakes. How can that be?
You know, and we're just now beginning to understand this. You know, historically, we as a country and even scientists really thought that this was a West Coast problem. But as technology improves and we're able to map more and more of the planet, what we're finding is that faults are everywhere. There's 2,100 known faults in the U.S. A good number of them are actually east of the Rockies. And as we begin to understand them better, we're also complicating what we know about them by way of this induced activity.
And the interesting word here in your sentence is known faults. I understand there's actually a lot of possibility. There's many faults we don't know anything about.
There could be exponentially more faults than these 2,100. And the reality of earthquakes in this country is that every major one has actually occurred on a fault that we didn't know about prior to that earthquake activity. And so every year, we're discovering dozens of new faults. And we don't yet know which one of those are capable of a major quake and which ones aren't.
Can you tell us about an earthquake or two that struck not where we would expect, somewhere maybe in the Midwest or the East Coast?
Sure. So your listeners may be familiar with the New Madrid Fault, which runs roughly under the Mississippi River and is a real issue, particularly for places like Memphis and St. Louis. They had a series of three devastating earthquakes in 1811, 1812. We know that fault is reloading. We know that eventually there will be another series of devastating earthquakes. Certainly if that happens in our lifetime, the repercussions are going to be not just for the Midwest, but for the entire country, and that's largely because places like Memphis are such a transportation hub. So much of our commerce passes through either on trucks or as a result of FedEx and UPS having their hubs there. And so it would be crippling for so many more people than just Midwesterners.
And one of the things about earthquakes, obviously there's human costs and the tragedy of the potential of a loss of life in an earthquake, but there's also the cost of it. Earthquakes are really expensive to recover from.
Easily billions of dollars. And it doesn't even take a major quake to do that. There have been some estimates that look at the seismic activity in a place like New York City, which is actually 40 years overdue for another moderate quake. And even that moderate quake could create as much damage, as much cost of damage as we saw in September 11th.
What do you think the United States needs to do to prepare itself? That seems to be the name of the game, and also something that's really hard to do. So what do you recommend?
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing that right now with Harvey and Houston. And in so many ways, these natural disasters, while they manifest in very different ways, the repercussions of them are very similar. And, you know, as a nation, we're really great at responding to crisis. We're really great at helping out one another and, you know, making sure that we're making donations and sending supplies and things like that and really rallying around a community as it's suffering. But we tend to lack imagination and initiative when it comes to that sort of forward looking, planning, that anticipating and responding to the disaster before it happens. And that's part of why we have outmoded infrastructure. It's part of why we don't have the same kind of resiliency plans that you see in other countries, and why we haven't invested in things like early warning programs that would really help, you know, give us that lead time of, say, 30 seconds or 60 seconds that could be a matter of life and death.
Do you see a big difference in the level of preparedness for an earthquake between, say, the West Coast, where they've had firsthand experience in the last 50 years, and the rest of the country?
Certainly some. You know, and if we look at a place like California, if there is a silver lining to California's earthquake history, it's that they've learned something crucial about a different infrastructure component each time. So, for instance, in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, the World Series earthquake, we saw that devastating effect to the overpasses and the highways that pancaked. And that resulted in new initiatives and new protocols for highway management there. One particular earthquake really leveled hospitals, and so they put new hospital initiatives in. But even California, you know, has obviously limited funds. Not all of the hospitals, for instance, have been able to make good on those mitigation standards. And even a lot of experts would say that the policies they have in place aren't enough. So it really is a collective problem for all of us.
We're talking to Catherine Miles right now. Her new book is called Quakeland, and we're talking about the science and statistics behind earthquakes in America and the threat that our guest says that they pose in the coming years. And Catherine, looking at the idea of an early warning system, is that possible? Earthquakes, they're notoriously hard to predict, and there's a lot we don't know about them.
That's so true. And I was really surprised by that. As I was talking to scientists for this book, they kept saying, you know, we know more about distant galaxies than we do about how the inner workings of our planet behaves. And prediction is something that we once really invested heavily in as a nation, and it's so far really proven elusive, and probably always will be. But there's a difference between prediction, which is saying, hey, 6 months from now, there's going to be an earthquake in L.A., to an early warning system, which is something that countries like Japan and Mexico already have in place. And this is something that, you know, would use your smartphone technology, would send you a text that says, you know, earthquake coming, you know, magnitude 6.1, 45 seconds. And that may not seem like a lot of time, but it's enough time to take shelter under a table. It's enough time to divert an airplane that's about to land or close a tunnel to prevent people from getting trapped.
Wow. So what sort of potential is there for warning with earthquakes? How much time can you get? You know, with a tornado, you can see it coming, you can gauge the conditions. What kind of warning is there for earthquakes?
Not nearly as much. And that's part of what makes earthquakes so terrifying. There's this new emerging field of psychology which looks at the effect of disasters on people's psyches. And what they found is that people have a far more visceral and damaging reaction to earthquakes that lasts a lot longer, a kind of PTSD-type phenomenon that seems more extreme than people who have experienced tornadoes and fires and hurricanes. And one reason is because it is so unknowable, and we don't know that it's coming. We don't see the skies gray up or turn that weird color of green that often happens before a tornado. We don't have the day or days that we have with a hurricane, and that's very unsettling.
What did the scientists that you talked to tell you about the cutting edge of earthquake science, what they really want to know and what they're close to finding out?
We still don't know what causes earthquakes to happen. We still don't really know. I mean, we understand that it's pressure differentials. It's a growing pressure. There's an emerging field of study that really suggests that hydrology is a lot more crucially involved than we ever thought. But, you know, when we see little earthquakes starting to happen sometimes, we can't really predict whether they're sort of harbingers of a big quake or whether they're just a little bit of seismic activity. It's such a new science. You know, even well into the 1960s, plate tectonics was considered highly suspicious as a sound theory, you know? So it's really a field in its infancy.
And when we talk about plate tectonics, I think most of us think, you know, plate tectonics, that's what's happening when an earthquake happens. The plates are shifting and they bump over one another or under, and then you've got your earthquake. But you say in your book that human activity is a big contributor.
Huge contributor, and that's been the big game changer of this century. Certainly prior to that, as long as we've been doing things like mining, like oil extraction, we've been causing earthquakes. But it's not really until this century that we've seen the full effect of that. And, you know, the most obvious example, of course, is what's happening in Oklahoma right now, where wastewater injection related with fracking is causing hundreds and hundreds of quakes a year, some of which are doing actual damage. But the surprise for me in this book was learning that, that fracking is literally the tip of the iceberg when it comes to induced seismicity. When Hoover Dam was built, the filling of Lake Mead, that reservoir there, created something like 10,000 earthquakes over the course of a decade. And it's even things, as you mentioned in the intro, things like the construction of these super high-rise buildings in places like Taipei, tunneling, mining, all of them are contributing to seismicity in a very real way.
And moving water, you say, tends to be a big contributor.
And this is what we're just beginning to understand. We've certainly seen, for instance, you know, an earthquake that happened in 1959 outside of Yellowstone significantly affected well levels in places like Puerto Rico. So we see that there's obviously a connection. One earthquake that happened in Pennsylvania about a decade or so ago caused all of the wells there to run dry and created wells and springs, you know, in Ohio where there hadn't been any. So we understand that there's fluidity. We understand, obviously, that, that water underground is held at pressure. But the degree to which its movement literally triggers earthquakes is still something of a mystery.
We're talking right now with journalist and author Catherine Miles about her new book called Quakeland, talking about the science of earthquakes.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever lived through an earthquake? What was that like? Do you think we as a nation are ready for earthquakes, taking enough precautions? And what questions do you have about the science of earthquakes? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit right here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now to journalist and author Catherine Miles about her new book called Quakeland. And she's making the case that earthquakes pose a huge threat to the United States in the coming years and decades, and that policymakers need to be doing more to get ready for that reality.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that's on your radar? Would you know what to do if an earthquake hit? Is this a threat that the government needs to take more seriously? And what kind of response do we need to be ready to have? And what questions do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Catherine, when you talk about preparedness, part of that is policy. What do you think that policymakers need to be doing to get ready for the threat of future earthquakes, especially when we see firsthand right now in our country the devastation after Hurricane Harvey?
Yes, and this is, again, you know, we see so many similarities between these catastrophic disasters. And, you know, one thing we know is that for decades we have been dramatically underfunding our nation's infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives our infrastructure a report card grade every few years. And for the past several of these report card cycles, we've earned a D average. And some particularly vulnerable areas of our infrastructure have earned even lower grades, things in particular like our dams and our levees. So this is something that really, you know, we need to own sooner rather than later, and not just because of a catastrophic natural disaster, but because it's interfering with efficiencies as well, too. So taking the time to actually shore up our grid, to really spend the money on our roads and bridges, our airports, ports, our levees, is something that's long overdue and really just can't wait any longer.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Darren joining us from Wyawega. Darren, hi.
How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Well, the comment I was going to give you was about living through an earthquake in Idaho in the 80s, but it goes back to the infrastructure part you just talked about, because the day the earthquake happened was the day we were moving from our old traditional high school brick and mortar false front to our brand new one that was built by the mining industry. And the old high school was destroyed in the earthquake, but the new one stood the test because it had to follow all the new codes. It was just perfect timing for that part, but not so much for the earthquake.
Wow, that's an incredible story. Darren, thank you for that. Darren has got a firsthand story of why it matters that we take into stock, you know, whether or not our buildings are ready to go in an event like that, Catherine.
That's right. And, you know, the idea that we can build buildings that do respond well to things like earthquakes is absolutely true, and absolutely something that we should be looking at. One of the things I detail in the book is a community in the Pacific Northwest who took the opportunity of building a new school to introduce a new bond initiative and created this very sophisticated tsunami platform so that all the kids can shelter in place. And that's the kind of forward thinking that we need to see more of.
Is there cross-pollination in scientists around the world? For example, Japan, where there are earthquakes happening quite a lot comparatively to some places in the United States, I would imagine that the building technology and engineering is different or more advanced in some cases.
Yes and no. If you look at, for instance, New Zealand, our building codes are remarkably similar, and our buildings are also remarkably similar. You know, this really is a global problem, and I think we all have a lot to learn from one another. Interestingly enough, you know, some of those kind of indigenous structures that look very not sophisticated to our naked eye, are ones that do remarkably well in earthquakes. We saw this in places like Mexico City and in Chile during the last big earthquake. You know, some of the newer buildings, you know, were kind of crumbling while these very old, you know, seem like crudely built buildings were the ones that were able to absorb the strain.
Let's take another caller now. Let's go to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi, I was wondering, with these little quakes, does that relieve pressure a little at a time so then maybe there won't be such a big earthquake?
And Dennis, thanks for that. Catherine, with little earthquakes, do seismologists know whether that does anything to kind of stave off a big one later on?
That's a great question. We're not entirely sure. They're what's called precursory action. Sometimes it just seems like these little quakes are just almost kind of like a little bit of a burp that's happening. But these little quakes can also be harbingers, foreshocks, if you will, for a much larger quake. What we're also learning is that these little quakes can shift the pressure and cause a bigger earthquake somewhere else. And so there's been a lot of study lately about how one quake, say, you know, in San Francisco can, in fact, cause an earthquake right down that San Andreas Fault Zone all the way down into, say, L.A. So maybe, but then they also may complicate things.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dennis. Appreciate that. And Catherine, you went to some really unusual places in the writing of this book. One of them, you went deep underground in a silver mine. What did you do there? What did you learn?
Yeah, I wanted this book to sort of be the classic road trip narrative. You know, I didn't want readers to think that this was a regional problem, and that seemed like the way to do it. The silver mine was fascinating. This is one of the deepest mines in the country. It's in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I spent a day with the staff geologist there, and we were down at depths of well over a mile, down at depths as low as 7,100 feet, where the temperature can be 130 degrees. And as these mines get deeper, particularly in places like the U.S. and South Africa, which has some of the deepest mines in the world, we're exerting more and more pressure, more and more influence on the ground down there. And what used to be known as rock bursts, these moments that, you know, unfortunately would maybe, you know, kill a few miners underground, but wouldn't do a lot of damage above ground, are now creating real seismic events that are having real consequences.
Is it surprising to you at all, as it is to me, in hearing stories like that about a mine going deep enough that it could interfere with the stability underneath? Because I think about the plates as being way deep in the center of the Earth, being so far down that it's not something that our little human technology can really get close to touching.
Yeah, and you know, that turns out not to be the case. We don't actually have to go down very far. And it doesn't even have to be at the edge of a plate. One of the more interesting stories that I detail in the book is this town of Plainfield, Connecticut, which in recorded history had never really had an earthquake, and a few years ago had 300 over the course of about 6 months. And we think it's because water seeped into an abandoned quarry and froze and thawed and froze and thawed over the course of a winter, and that created this bizarre earthquake swarm, which really unsettled the town.
I can imagine. Well, let's take another caller. Let's go to Philip in Eau Claire. Philip, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Not bad. How are you?
Doing pretty good. My question is, I'm originally from southern Illinois, actually south of St. Louis, and I know the New Madrid Fault goes through that area. Back when I was in college in the 80s, our rock instructor... our geology instructor, mm-hmm. was talking to us about the fact that area of the country at that point was having about 150 to 200 earthquakes a year that were so deep that they couldn't be felt. And he said that the fear is, and that, you know, I'm just curious as to what it is now, that he said within the next 50 to 100 years that those earthquakes will probably come to the surface and will be so tremendous and so dangerous because of all of the mining that has been done throughout the Midwest, and especially in Illinois, the coal mines, that it will make anything that's ever happened in California look like a child's game.
Wow. Well, that's terrifying. Philip, Catherine, is there anything to that?
I don't know anything about the direct correlation between mining and the New Madrid seismic zone. That's not something I came across. But certainly the threat of a major earthquake on the New Madrid zone is very real. Through study, we've identified three sets of earthquakes that have happened over the course of sort of geologic time there. They occurred at roughly about 400 years apart. That's not really a large enough sample size to say that we know when the next one's going to happen, but we do know that there were three very devastating earthquakes in 1811 there, naturally caused, that were above an 8.0, which certainly makes them significant, and that those are probably going to happen again. Will it happen today? Will it happen in 100 years? We don't know. But what emergency managers and planners say, look, it doesn't matter if it happens now or in 100 years. We really need to get ready for it right now.
Well, Philip, thank you so much. And Catherine, appreciate you joining us today. In a couple seconds left here, what can we do to get ready, maybe on the personal level?
Absolutely. You know, and in an afternoon, we can do so much. We can pack a go bag with supplies. We can make sure that our bookcases are bolted to walls. We can make sure that we have a plan of communication if our cell phones go down. And this is something we should be doing for any disaster.
Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Catherine Miles, a journalist and writer in residence for Green Mountain College. Her new book is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. What about you? Have you lived through an earthquake? Lynn on Facebook says she was in Los Angeles in 1971 for the San Fernando earthquake. My reaction to this was astounding, she says. Took me days to recover my normal activity. We'd love to hear your story. And what you think we need to do going forward, change policy, get ready, make disaster plans for our families. Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.